Hello and welcome to IT Conversations, a series of interviews with experts in today's hot topics in information technology. I'm your host, Doug Kay, the CEO of RDS Strategies, and today I'll be discussing the SCO Group's legal actions regarding Linux and the implications for IT managers with Eben Moglen, Professor of Law and Legal History at Columbia Law School and the General Counsel of the Free Software Foundation. Welcome, Eben, and thanks for joining me today.
My pleasure.
Eben, we'll get into SCO versus IBM in a moment. But let's start with some context. What is the Free Software Foundation, and what does it do?
The Free Software Foundation is a charitable corporation organized under the laws of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. What it does is to promote and assist the development and distribution of free software, which means software that can be copied, modified, improved, and redistributed by its users. Under licensing arrangements which make that distribution free. By free here, we mean, as the foundation's founder and guiding intellect, Richard Stallman, has said for the past 20 years, free as in speech, not free as in beer. The purpose of free software is to give users of technology freedom. Freedom to understand the technology that they use, freedom to fix, improve, and adapt it, and freedom to share that technology with anybody whom the users want to and can help. Because free software can be improved by everyone who uses it, because everyone gets source code, and not just gets source code, but is free to make changes to the code and redistribute those changes, because free software can be improved by its users, it gets better very quickly. The Free Software Foundation has two major roles to play in that free software environment. It makes and distributes free software. The GCC compiler, the GLibC C library, GNU Emacs, GNU Tar, and many other programs are works that the Free Software Foundation distributes out of its own authorship. The Free Software Foundation also enables other parties to make and distribute free software of their own. We do this, among other things, by publishing two licenses, the GNU General Public License, known around the world as GPL, and its cousin, the Lesser General Public License, known as LGPL. These are licenses, copyright licenses, which help people to organize the legal consequences of copying, modifying, and sharing programs in a defensible way. The Free Software Foundation ensures compliance with those licenses by helping parties who distribute free software in disrespectful ways to get right with history. And the foundation considers, modifies, and redistributes those licenses in order to keep them current with the needs of technology and the needs of the software industry.
And how did you personally get involved with FSF?
Well, in 1991, I was representing a man named Philip Zimmerman. Phil had created a program called Pretty Good Privacy, PGP, which was the first program to do strong public key encryption in a form that ordinary personal computer users could access and understand. Phil was accordingly in some trouble with the United States government, which took the position then and for years after that, that strong encryption freely spread throughout civil society would be bad for the national security interests of the United States. So I was representing Phil in connection with a government criminal investigation of the wrongfulness, as the U.S. government saw it, of making and distributing such software for people to use. Richard Stallman, the president of the Free Software Foundation, became aware that I was doing that work on Zimmerman's behalf, and he called me up to ask me if I could help him with a particular legal problem that he then had. And so I represented Richard in connection with that problem and became aware of the many, many valuable possibilities inherent in the free software idea. Richard had formed the GNU Project in 1982, the Free Software Foundation in 1985. He'd won a MacArthur Prize in 1990, and I knew about that, and I knew who he was, but I hadn't thought about the enormous possibilities that lay before the free software movement at that time. When I started doing his legal work in 92, I realized how great the possibilities were, and I decided to sign on for the duration of the revolution, offering him whatever legal services I could provide and he needed without asking for a fee. In 1993, it became clear to me that that process was indeed going to be a lengthy process, and I agreed with him to become general counsel of the Free Software Foundation, pro bono publico, as lawyers put it, for the public good, that is to say, without taking a fee, and I stayed in that position ever since for the last 10 years. Beginning in 1997, I went on his board of directors and have served as part of the foundation's directorate thereafter as well.
Let me try and set the stage for the recent events. Correct me if I make a mistake here. Through a number of acquisitions, SCO came to own certain rights in the Unix operating system. Then, seemingly out of the blue, SCO sued IBM, claiming that as part of Linux, IBM released some of the source code that SCO had licensed to IBM for use in their AIX operating system. Was that indeed the first step in all of this?
Yes, that's correct. The only change I would make is to say that SCO said that its predecessor, AT&T, the originator of Unix, had licensed that code to IBM. SCO had never itself directly licensed anything to IBM, but it had inherited, it said, the rights of the licensors.
You've commented publicly on some of the early examples of infringing code that have been presented by Darryl McBride, SCO's president and CEO. What did you find when you looked at those examples?
Well, in all the cases that we have so far seen where SCO has claimed that code from versions of Unix had made its way into the Linux program, it has made two kinds of errors. It has inappropriately and rather aggressively claimed that it had rights in the code without checking first to see whether it actually had rights in the code. And the second thing that it has done is to allege that similarities of code imply literal copying, which over the domain of the code they have in mind is not the case. So, for example, SCO has argued that an implementation of the Berkeley packet filter protocol, the BPF, which was present in BSD Unix, belongs to it and has been copied into the program called Linux. Both, on closer inspection, turned out to be either doubtful or ascertainably incorrect. The implementation of the Berkeley packet filtering code that is in the Linux kernel is the independent authorship of a Linux developer, Jay Shulist. That code is not code subject to a claim of literal copying from anywhere. Jay just wrote it. It's similar to code which has existed in the Unix Sys 5 product, to which SCO has rights, as it has existed in previous Unixes. It comes from BSD. Now, the question of whether SCO has any rights in the BSD part of the code, that is, whether it can successfully claim copyright in that code, is mysterious, too. It's complicated. It has to do with how you understand the legal outcome of the dispute between the AT&T and Unix System Labs and BSD, a lawsuit which ended inconclusively with a settlement, but with substantial suggestions that even code which AT&T had claimed it had rights in it for complex technical reasons did not. What was important here about SCO's example was that Darryl McBride showed this code side by side with Linux code on a screen in Las Vegas and said, there it is, our code in the Linux free software program. Wrong both times. Not his code for sure, by any means, and not copied into Linux, but independently re-implemented. There are only so many ways that you can write computer code that does packet filtering using the header names that are assigned in the standard. And if you re-implement achieving the same function, you're likely to use rather similar expressions, particularly if you're using the same computer language, in this case, C. So the code looks very similar, it is very similar, but that doesn't make it copyright infringement. In another instance, Mr. McBride showed code which had been literally copied. It had been literally copied, and it was okay literally to copy it, because Caldera, Sco's predecessor, had itself released that code under a free software license, the BSD license. This particular code, there was reason to suppose they didn't have a power to license, because they didn't have a copyright in it either. But at any rate, they'd claimed to have a copyright in it, they licensed it for free use, and Silicon Graphics had reused it for a potential version of the Linux kernel to run on Silicon Graphics 64-bit hardware. The SGI workers had indeed removed the copyright notice that Caldera had put there. If Caldera had a legitimate copyright interest in that code, removing the notice would have been a bad thing to have done. If they didn't have a legitimate copyright interest, it's no harm, no foul. Mr. McBride went pretty quickly past that point. But more important, SGI, though it put that code in a branch of the Linux operating system kernel, never released any machines that ran that kernel, because SGI never shipped 64-bit hardware that met the IA64 architecture. Hewlett-Packard ships 64-bit IA64 computers. They call them Itanium. But Hewlett-Packard had long since modified the kernel to remove the particular code that Mr. McBride was showing. So in this instance, Mr. McBride showed code which it was doubtful Caldera had a copyright in, therefore doubtful SCO had any ownership in, which had indeed been taken for use in the Linux operating system kernel because there was a license that permitted that code to be taken. It had been mishandled in transit, though it's not clear that that mishandling had any bad legal effect, and moreover, it wasn't part of an operating system kernel that anybody in the world was actually running on any real hardware. Nonetheless, Mr. McBride jumped up and down and waved his arms and said it was a big deal, which it most certainly wasn't.
Somewhere along the line, the GNU General Public License under which Linux is distributed has become part of the focus of the attention here. Can you explain the relevant parts of the GPL and why they're now part of this suit?
Yeah. Initially, the GPL was just a problem for Mr. McBride and his company. What SCO had actually said in its lawsuit against IBM when they filed it was, one, we have trade secret claims because we had a license, which we inherited the licensor side of, that was the AT&T license for Unix technology to IBM, and that license said, you may use this Unix code, but you can't give away our know-how, except under conditions which restrict people's republication of it. We say, Mr. IBM, that you took that code under license from AT&T, made AIX out of it, and then turned around and contributed it to the Linux program. And when you did that, you gave it away in a free software sense, which goes beyond what the license allowed you to do. And we therefore have a trade secret claim that you've misappropriated our trade secrets. Now, when SCO said that in its initial complaint against IBM, they had a problem. The problem they had was that SCO itself was distributing the Linux program under GPL. And the problem, therefore, was how can you maintain a trade secret lawsuit, even assuming that Unix was a trade secret beforehand, if you yourself are giving away to everybody under a license that says they can freely copy, modify, and distribute it, the very same thing you're claiming is a secret that IBM wasn't keeping well. So the GPL distribution of the Linux program by SCO posed an obstacle to SCO's trade secret claim against IBM. That wasn't a very serious problem for SCO, because SCO didn't really expect to win its trade secret claim against IBM. The next thing that SCO did in the course of last summer was to send letters to the Fortune 1500 saying, if you are using the Linux operating system kernel in your businesses, you should be taking a license from us and you should pay us money. This was a very important move because SCO's job here was to raise its stock price, And merely having a contract and trade secret lawsuit against IBM wasn't likely to raise its stock price much. What was really going to boost the value of SCO's shares was the announcement to the market that they had unspecifiedly but expensively enforceable legal claims against the Fortune 1500 and everybody else besides, who should be taking a very expensive license to use what had previously been thought of as software that anybody could freely use. That made the stock shoot up, but it also now meant that SCO had a different GPL problem. Because now it was demanding of people out there in the world that they take additional license terms on GPL software that they themselves had distributed. Again, they were distributing the Linux operating system kernel as part of their business. Now, what GPL says, what the GNU General Public License says, is the essence of free software. And I can put that essence in a sentence. It goes like this. Take this software. Do anything you want with it. Make new things out of it. Distribute it, modified or unmodified, to whomever you please. But if you redistribute, whether modified or unmodified versions of this software, your permission only extends to redistribution under the terms of this license and no additional terms. That's how the GPL works. It says, take this software, do anything you want, but whatever you do with it, you have to contribute it back to the world of GPL. If you use our parts to make new machines, you have to put those new machines back in the commons from which you got the parts. So SCO, distributing under GPL, was not only distributing its own copyrighted work, if it had copyrights in the kernel, it was distributing lots of other people's work too. And those people had said, you may freely redistribute my work, provided that you distribute only under this license. When SCO began to threaten users of the Linux OS kernel with taking additional license terms, it was laying itself open to a counterclaim under GPL, a counterclaim which IBM then filed at the end of the summer. IBM said, wait a minute, Mr. SCO, you're distributing our copyrighted work in the Linux kernel because you don't dispute that we have works of authorship that we have contributed to the Linux kernel and that we had a right to contribute. You're distributing those works. And you're trying to put them under new terms, terms that go beyond the GPL. That's a violation of the GPL. You are not in compliance with GPL. I think IBM is entirely correct in that claim. SCO then responded by saying, but the GPL is invalid. Now, this was a claim that SCO didn't want to have to make. If you look in the September issue of Wired magazine, you'll find an interview with Darryl McBride, which was written in June sometime. And in the course of that interview, Mr. McBride was asked, why aren't you suing Red Hat, another prominent distributor of free software? And Mr. McBride responds, because if we sue Red Hat, the whole GPL system will come apart, and we don't want to do that. Now, indeed, that was an overestimate of his litigation strength, but it stands for the proposition that back in June, Mr. McBride didn't want to be fundamentally arguing about the GPL. By the end of the summer, he had no choice. His worsening legal situation with IBM compelled him to argue that the GPL was somehow not a valid copyright permission. So he was pushed to it, in part by the circumstances of his own litigation. The other reason that he would push to it, I would speculate, is that he had taken $10 million, supposedly as a license fee, from a company called Microsoft. And Microsoft, whatever else may be its interest in this situation, has made perfectly clear that it dislikes the GPL. When Mr. McBride signed up to fight this fight on behalf of Microsoft, to the extent that he did that, he was also taking on Microsoft's animus against the GPL, which he now found himself arguing in terms reminiscent of statements made previously by Microsoft executives, was a threat to the global software industry, was un-American, was unconstitutional, and so on and so forth.
To what extent do the antics of McBride in the press and the way this has played out very publicly affect the legal issues involved with the initial litigation?
Well, to be precise, of course, not at all. The legal claims rest on certain facts and certain applications of law, and nothing that Mr. McBride says is going to change that.
Let's take a look at what the implications of this might be. Obviously, the outcome is still up in the air, and I think it's fair to say that this has become somewhat of the O.J. Simpson case of the IT industry. Let's suppose for the moment that it turns out that IBM is found liable for certain infringements here. What would be the implications? What would happen then to Linux and the source code?
Well, the first thing we have to say is that the difference between this and the O.J. Simpson case is that in the O.J. Simpson case, there were two dead people, and that was an absolute fact. Nobody has so far demonstrated that there are any dead anythings here, and it's important to keep in mind that at this moment, and for the next 30 days until SCO meets the obligations imposed upon it by the court in Utah last Friday, there's no demonstration that there's any problem of any kind. But let's suppose for a moment that there is a problem. And now, again, we have to go back to the point which your question assumes, which is, suppose IBM is found liable for infringements, having in mind that SCO hasn't asserted any infringements by IBM of copyright law. But let's, again, cover that by supposing that when it all is said and done, we discovered that there are in the program called Linux some lines of code literally copied from something SCO has rights in. Whether those came through IBM or in any other way, the result would be the same. The authors of the Linux program, who are many thousands of people around the world, would take that code out and write new code and put it in. That process would take however long it takes, depending upon how many lines of code there are. Mr. McBride, in the course of what you call his antics, has occasionally suggested that there might be so much as a million lines of such code. But I think everybody recognizes that that's not the case. If there are examples of literal copying from some Unix code base stock into the program called Linux, they are inadvertent, casual, and they are therefore likely to be slight. They would simply be rewritten from scratch by some other programmer and replaced into the kernel. That process would not take very long. In theory, there is some damages liability, and that damages liability is measured by lost sales or by so-called statutory damages, that is, proof of damages without proof of actual economic harm. Those damages could only start to accrue when SCO registered its copyrights, which is why it went through the process of announcing last spring that it had registered its copyrights.
Was that a clue that this was coming?
That's correct. It was not just a clue. It was an announcement in a form which a lawyer would understand. So SCO would claim that it has damages rights against somebody, and in order to assert those damages claims, it would have to bring them against a somebody guilty of infringement. And it would have to make a copyright claim, which it is important to point out it has so far not done against anybody, including IBM. It would have to show that that person literally copied and then subsequently distributed its copyrighted work without permission. As Mr. Torvalds, the lead developer of Linux, has again and again said, SCO should just come forward and show what they're talking about that infringes. SCO keeps saying it doesn't want to do that because the code will be replaced easily. They mean they don't want to do what a plaintiff has to do because they don't want to have happen what would inevitably happen, which is that it would turn out to be no very big deal, and the authors and developers of Linux would replace the infringing code rapidly.
In traditional software, non-open source software, it's pretty common for the vendors to indemnify customers from claims of third parties. Now, Hewlett-Packard has offered to indemnify its Linux customers from claims by SCO and others, either within the scope of the current controversy or beyond it, after the dust settles here. Do you see indemnification becoming an important part of the open source picture?
Well, let's go back to the beginning of your statement, which is that it's pretty common for software manufacturers of proprietary software to indemnify customers. I agree with you that it is not unheard of, but it's important to recognize that, indemnification of individual one-unit purchasers is not common at all. Microsoft, it is true, will indemnify you against third-party claims with respect to Windows if you buy a lot of Windows licenses. If you go to Microsoft and you say, I want to buy 10,000 seats, but I want an indemnification agreement as part of my contract with you, they'll write one with you. IBM will do the same with respect to its proprietary software. I have no doubt that Red Hat would be willing to do that for third-party against third-party claims for free software if you bought enough units. What has not ever been common in the software industry was to indemnify onesie purchasers of software, free or unfree. What's unusual about the Hewlett-Packard offer that you refer to is that it goes down to the individual consumer. If you buy Hewlett-Packard hardware and you run unmodified free software on it, Hewlett-Packard says it will provide you an indemnity even at the onesie level against third-party claims. What that tells the knowledgeable observer of the industry is that Hewlett-Packard thinks that those third-party claims are meritless. It's giving away something which it doesn't think is very valuable. I think you would be basically historically correct if you speculated that what happened at Hewlett-Packard was this. The product managers for lots of hardware that runs free software came to Hewlett-Packard's lawyers, I would guess, and said, what would it cost us to provide an indemnification against third-party claims? And the lawyers looked at the legal situation and said, ice in the wintertime. And Hewlett-Packard's product managers said, great, then we're going to announce that we're giving away ice in the wintertime, as indeed, in my judgment, they have. I think it's adroit marketing, and I think it reflects the recognition on the part of Hewlett-Packard's lawyers that third-party claims against free software at the moment don't look like a very serious business risk that they would want to slow their product managers down in assuming on behalf of customers. This is a way for Hewlett-Packard to sell hardware, and I think it's a good way to sell hardware. Now, you asked me what's going to happen in the future, leaving SCO aside. I think in the future, leaving SCO aside, that there are insurance products concerning free software which people are inclined, certain people, in certain segments of the market, at certain times, inclined to buy. And I would expect the insurance market to offer the products that people want to buy.
As one part of the ongoing soap opera here, David Boies is part of the picture. We all got to know Mr. Boies of Boies, Schiller, and Flexner when he argued the Bush versus Gore case in front of the Supreme Court. Of course, he also represented the U.S. federal government in its generally unsuccessful case against Microsoft. But he's a pretty smart guy. Why would Boies take a case that, from your perspective, is so cut and dry?
Well, let's go back a further still in David Boies' career. David began as an associate and then as a partner at Cravath, Swain & Moore, IBM's lawyers, under the tutelage of Thomas D. Barr, the partner who provided IBM with its legal defense against the United States government and private antitrust plaintiffs in U.S. against IBM. David, in other words, grew up as a lawyer in the system of IBM, its defense against the federal government on antitrust claims. David severed his relationships with Cravath and left to form Boies, Schiller, and Flexner some years ago. It is unusual for Cravath partners to go out on their own that way. It was a very surprising development about which there is undoubtedly a story that none of us knows. I think David Boies got into SCO because it was an opportunity for him to go up against the client and the firm from which he began his career. I think the attraction of that activity was probably in part personal. I think his attractiveness to SCO arose from the fact that he was not only a lawyer who had recently been seen as prominent, but one who knew IBM and IBM's litigation law firm, Cravath, intimately well. I think it therefore looked like a good match all around. I know David Boies a little bit. I have worked at Cravath, Swain & Moore, too, and on IBM cases. though I was a very junior lawyer at exactly the moment that David was a Cravath partner on the verge of leaving, and we have no established professional relationship of any kind. I happened to be clerking in the United States Supreme Court when he argued another case there on behalf of a large client called Texaco, at a time when Texaco had sustained a $10 billion loss to Pennzoil in the Texas state courts, and Mr. Boies had been retained to try and bail them out in the federal courts in New York and in the United States Supreme Court. My estimation of Mr. Boies is that he is an extremely skillful litigator who is sometimes not as well prepared as he might wish to be. I think that people saw that happen in the 2000 presidential election case in the Florida Supreme Court, when Mr. Boies was asked by a justice on the Florida Supreme Court at the time of the first litigation how long it would take to perform the recount that Mr. Boies was asking for on behalf of the Gore campaign. And without any preparation, but in need of an answer on the spot, Mr. Boies told the Florida Supreme Court it will take 10 days. I believe that that's the moment at which Mr. Gore lost the presidential election, not in the subsequent Supreme Court activity, but at the moment that the Florida Republican Party was told by Mr. Boies and by the Florida Supreme Court how long they had to delay in order to maintain their aura of being victors in Florida. Mr. Boies, I think, depends very much upon skill. Sometimes, not always by any means, but sometimes, to the exclusion of preparation. I don't think Mr. Boies knew what the merits of this lawsuit were when he filed it. I don't think he understood the free software world very well. That's not surprising. SCO didn't either. And what his client couldn't teach him, he could not learn. I think the consequence was that within a fairly short period of time, Mr. Boies became a little bit disillusioned with the possibilities of this lawsuit. I think that's confirmed by the fact that I haven't seen Mr. Boies touch this lawsuit in some months now. He has not made a public appearance. He has not argued in court on behalf of the client. He has not signed any papers. The lawyer who appears to be conducting this lawsuit on behalf of Boies, Shiller & Flexner is a partner named Mark Heise, who, whatever his characteristics are, is not David Boies. I note, moreover, that on the most important court date that this lawsuit has so far had, which was its appearance in court last Friday in the Federal District Court in Utah, at which SCO was ordered to turn over the information about which portions of the Linux program it claims it has rights in, no lawyer from Boies, Shiller & Flexner was arguing at all. Mr. Heise was not there. The lawsuit was the appearance in the lawsuit was made by Darryl McBride's brother, Kevin, a practitioner in Utah. I think Boies, Shiller & Flexner, about whose compensation we now know a little bit, it was revealed in a public filing earlier this month that Boies, Shiller & Flexner has been paid $1 million in cash and $8 million in SCO stock. I think Boies, Shiller & Flexner should now be regarded as an investor in SCO. SCO is no longer a company that makes software. SCO is a company that produces a lawsuit. Boies, Shiller & Flexner is an investor in the success of that lawsuit. They have much to gain if it works. They have little left to gain if it doesn't work. And I think, hard as this is to say, I think at the moment, Boies, Shiller & Flexner is probably a little bit sorry that they're as undiversified an investor in that lawsuit as they now appear to be.
It was interesting that in a press conference I attended in Las Vegas, McBride explained that Boies actually receives a percentage of license fees as well. So if part of the resolution of this case is, in fact, to enforce licenses, that's another way by which they'll profit, as well as an equity holder, I believe, in the company.
Though I also see that the Royal Bank of Canada, which has invested $50 million in SCO, announced earlier this week that it was rewriting its investment deal to provide itself with powers of veto over lawyer compensation agreements. I don't know whether that's RBC's way of deciding to take back an investment by making terms which are not going to be acceptable to SCO, or whether it represents the beginning of a fight over the carcass. It is certainly true that the arrangements between SCO and Boies-Schiller and Flexner are a little unusual to the extent that we know about them. But then I think they concentrate still more of our attention on the fact that SCO stock has gone up so much since the beginning of this litigation. I think it is a story about the stock market as much as it is a story about technology.
And finally, as you take a look at this case and given your experience with similar matters, over what time frame do you expect this to be resolved?
Well, if it were about getting to trial and having matters decided there, then it would take us another 12 to 18 months to get there. I don't think we're going to get that far. I don't think this story plays out in the form of SCO lasts all the way to a trial and IBM has to prove its claims and defend itself against SCO down to the end. I think it is much more likely that we will see a collapse than that we will see a victory in court. A number of things might happen. The price of SCO's stock might start to fall. If the price of SCO's stock started to fall, then parties unhappy with that might make some claims and look at SCO's representations and factual statements a little clearly, and that might precipitate an unwinding of the situation. It might become clear that SCO's factual support for its lawsuit against IBM is not very strong. If its factual support for its lawsuit against IBM is not very strong, then third parties who are asked to take licenses will be relaxed in their view and will say, well, we can afford to wait for the outcome of the IBM litigation. Without the ongoing possibility of license fees coming in from third parties, SCO will not look so strong. Its stock price will begin to subside, and investors will be less likely to put money in. I think it is quite possible that 6 months from now we'll be wondering why we thought the SCO case was going to last 2 years.
Well, this is yet another fascinating milestone on the road of the open source movement. Evan, I want to thank you very much for being with me today.
My pleasure. I look forward to having an opportunity to talk with you in future when the free software movement attains yet new milestones along the way.
And I want to thank all of you for listening to today's edition of IT Conversations. This edition was recorded on December 12, 2003. My guest has been Evan Moglen, the professor of law and legal history at Columbia Law School and the general counsel of the Free Software Foundation. You'll find their website at www.gnu.org. That's G-N-U for those of you who aren't familiar with it. IT Conversations is a production of RDS Strategies, LLC. Please visit our website at www.rds.com. My name is Doug Kay, and I hope you'll join me next time for another edition of IT Conversations.